War tends to bring a people together. It's a simple affair. The goals are clear: to win. To win, obviously, a people must pull together. Peace is far more complex. When peace follows war, a country usually breaks out again into faction. Peace destroys the wartime unity. An army marches in unison. Civilians tend to go their own way in all directions. Now, many of us forget that when the colonists, or a good part of them, rebelled against England, the England of King George III, they did not do so as citizens of a single state, but as citizens of 13 sovereign communities, the 13 colonies. There was surprisingly little cohesion between the colonies before the American Revolution. There are very few business partnerships between men of separate colonies. The sociologists have indeed studied the matter and found that there were very few intermarriages between people of the separate colonies. Each had its own traditions. Many of them had separate religious histories. Each had its own law. And if it had not been for the shared dangers and the shared experiences and shared responsibilities of the war, the sense of a national unity might never have emerged. Indeed, had it not been for the need to create a central command and a Continental Congress, one might have had disparate bands of rebels here and there fighting against the British. But somehow the needs of making war overcame parochialism and a measure of a sense of common purpose emerged. But when the Continental Congress in 1777 began to work on what came to be called the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, which was the first constitution of our country, what they created, in fact, was not a single nation, but a league of friendship between 13 separate nations who agreed to give up a measure of their independence in the areas of common defense and foreign affairs and of Indian matters, but who jealously and zealously reserved for themselves independence in most other spheres of activity. So that the United States in Congress assembled, which was the long and rather lugubrious term for the first Congress, was in fact not a Congress of representatives of the people, but a place where ambassadorial groups came, sent by the several colonies to meet. Each had a single vote. Each state had a single vote. And any state which did not want to participate in the decision of the United States in Congress assembled simply did not do so. There was no independent executive. Like the UN today, there was no power of taxation. All that could be done was to request a requisition from the states sufficient monies to carry out agreed upon activities. In effect, each of the states had a veto power over the decisions of the central legislature. And clearly, these Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, which were not easily adopted, it took 5 years, from 1777 to 1781, before these Articles of Confederation were ratified by each and all of the states. Clearly, what was envisioned was a league of friendship, a diplomatic union, not unlike the common market of Europe today, where the several states reserved for themselves very large measures of independence and of sovereignty. But in the post-war years, a number of problems arose with this loose confederation. lacking a central judiciary, a Supreme Court, there was no place to which the states could bring the inevitable quarrels which arose among them. The state of New York had the major port of the colonies, and the state of New York began to impose very high custom and import tariffs on all the goods that were brought in. And it got into a very bitter argument with the state of New Jersey, which used the port of New York for most of its imports, which argued that the custom prices and tariffs were far too high for things which were simply being shipped through. And when New York refused to lower its tariffs, New Jersey looked around for a way to get even, and it found that it owned the land under the major lighthouse that guarded New York Harbor, Sandy Hook, and it simply charged an exorbitant fee to New York State for the rental of the land under its lighthouse. As a matter of fact, when the Constitutional Convention was finally organized, it came into being for a quite mundane reason. The states of Virginia and of Maryland had a bitter argument over navigation rights in the Potomac, and they could not settle the argument, and the statesmen from the two communities had the good sense to realize that they were simply living through a frustration common to all the colonies, and they suggested to the Congress that their situation was not atypical and that the Congress ought to call into being a committee representative of all the states to review the Articles of Confederation and to amend them. And such is the birth of our present Constitution. But it was not only that the Articles of Confederation failed to provide for a national judiciary. There was no power of taxation. And as a result, when the central government requested money to repay the loans from France and from Holland, which had helped to support the colonists during the American Revolution, many of the states were not willing to pay their fair share. And the United States during those early years had often to default on its loans from abroad. And these countries, instinctively friendly to the new nation, began to retaliate by denying to American merchants in Amsterdam and in Paris privilege which they much needed. And not only did these early colonies lack a central judiciary, and not only did they lack the power of taxation, but they lacked the ability even to enforce their own regulations. That is, that this new body, the United States in Congress assembled, should have the right to create foreign policy and to provide for the common defense, and that the state should delegate to the central body that right. During these years, the state of Georgia, on its own, got into a very bitter Indian war. And this war had great ramifications for the relationship of the colonies with both Spain and France. But nevertheless, Georgia went ahead and prosecuted its war without concern for the larger issues. It was men of property and men of power who first came to realize the limitations of the Articles of Confederation. Largely, this was the group of men who had run the Continental Armies and the Continental Congress, who had learned to come together and to share in common purpose and to plan together. They learned that they spoke similar languages, that they shared many ideas and many privileges, and they began to argue for the importance of some new definition of the national unity. This is a relatively conservative structure, and the conservatism was increased by events of the middle 1780s. These were years of inflation in the cost of manufactured products and of deflation in the cost of farm products. More and more lands were being opened and were being farmed. There was more produce than the colonies could consume. Farmers were in serious financial trouble. And the men of property who controlled many of the state legislatures were unwilling to allow paper money to be circulated. They kept money very dear. And particularly in New England, the debtors' courts were kept very busy, as mortgages on farms and farm buildings were foreclosed, and even as farmers were being thrown into jail for debt. And the result was that in 1786, a man named Daniel Shays of Massachusetts led about 1,500 fellow farmers who felt abused by these conditions into Northampton, where one of these debtors' courts was meeting, and they simply sat into the court and refused to allow it to proceed. And then they freed a few debtors from prison and marched off into the hills of the Berkshires and began what might have been a guerrilla war. Now, in point of fact, this rebellion was very easily put down. But it sent tremors of concern down through the men of property in the colonies. And they felt that there was need for some central planning agency for fiscal affairs. Though by the Articles of Confederation, the Congress had been given the power to mint coins, money, in point of fact, several of the states believed in easy money and several states believed in tighter money, and no national coinage had been minted. And no fiscal policy for the whole of the community had been organized. Law and order, the need to eliminate discriminatory tariffs, to create a single market, all things of interest to men of power and privilege, was among the major reasons why the founding fathers came together to create our Constitution. But it was not the only reason, and it's fortunate it was not. For as much as they believed in law and order, they believed equally, or feared equally, tyranny. They feared the power which is arrogated by those who assume national office. After all, they'd fought a bloody war for many years against what they called tyranny, the actions of Great Britain, of George III. And most of the men who came together, who were sent by the several states to the Continental Congress, were men who came out of the Puritan tradition, whose ancestors had fought a long, centuries-long battle in England against what they called the tyranny of the church state, of the Anglican Church in alliance with the royal power. And those who were lawyers, and 75% of those who came to the Continental Congress were lawyers, had been trained in the English legal system, which since the days of the Magna Carta had attempted to, by due process and other means, establish the rights of the individual as opposed to the rights of the state. These men had no illusion about the simple fact that power corrupts, and that if one gives too much power to anyone, he will be corrupted by that power and he will come to abuse that power. And they knew full well that human nature being corruptible, man being by nature sinful, it was necessary to create power and at the same time to limit the ability of any group to manage that power without being constrained by other powers. And so you got slowly developing the concept of the separation of powers, which is basic to our Constitution. In the months immediately after the writing of the Constitution, before it was finally ratified, John Jay and James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, as you know, wrote a series of some 50-odd letters, which we now call the Federalist Papers, to convince the electors of the state of New York that the Constitution ought to be ratified. In one of these, James Madison, our future president, set down very clearly the philosophy which undergirds our Constitution and which was basic to the thinking of most Americans of the time. The great security against a gradual concentration of the several powers in the same department consists in giving to those who administer each department the necessary constitutional means and personal motives to resist encroachment of the others. The provision for defense must, in this as in all other cases, be made commensurate to the danger of attack. Ambition must be made to counteract ambition. The interest of the man must be connected with the constitutional rights of the place. It may be a reflection on human nature that such devices should be necessary to control the abuses of government. But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. Now we have in our day a large number of romantics, of rather naive ideologues, who look to create some utopian scheme, some single plan of government, which will free all of us and be gracious to all of us and allow all of us to do our own thing. But 200 years ago, when the men assembled for our Constitutional Convention, they were heirs of a much longer and wiser tradition, a tradition which had no illusions about human nature. Each of us is corruptible. Each of us has needs of ambition and power and status. None of us is an angel. This being so, of the best of us, clearly, in order to have law and order and justice, that is power, there must be mechanisms of power. But in order to protect freedom, to protect all of us from the abuses of those who will inevitably abuse their power, there must be checks and balances on their use of that power. Now, this was a tradition of Enlightenment political theory. This was a tradition of English jurisprudence. Most of these men had been educated, had been well educated in the classic tradition. And reading Solon and Lycurgus of Plato and Aristotle, they knew about the tyrannies and the oligarchies of ancient Greece, the abuse of power in those communities. And they were also heirs of our own tradition, of the biblical tradition. Al tiftachum binedivim, do not trust in princes. About the 11th century before the Common Era, when the tribes of Israel were first coming into their own as a confederacy and establishing their control over the Holy Land, there arose a condition among the ancient Israelites not unlike the condition which faced the colonists as they tried to create unity, a nation. Our fathers came of the separate tribes. I read today the Torah portion of Exodus, which describes the 12 names of the sons of Jacob, whose names were given or used by these tribes. These tribes were fiercely independent. They were bound together by ties of language, to a certain degree by a religious bond through the covenant, by certain common historic traditions that came through one basic history. But they acknowledged no central government. There was a united Israel in Congress assembled, which was called Kol Yisrael, an erratic, occasional meeting of the chiefs of the several tribes who would come together for some common purpose. But every tribe had the right to absent itself from a common decision. And the books of Joshua and Judges indicate to us quite clearly that there were times of great danger when one tribe would summon the other tribes to its aid and a number of the tribes would not respond. There were times when over various issues of land and of water, the tribes fell to fighting with each other. Occasionally, when there was a perceived common danger, they would appoint a shofet. We translate this title as judge, but it's really a commissioned sheikh who has a temporary commission to organize an army for the defense of the group. But immediately upon the end of that battle, he must release the army and relieve himself of his authority. During that period of time, Israel feared tyranny. They feared kingship, malchut. They saw kings of all the nations among them, but they were semi-Bedouin. They were not used to that tradition, and they knew the abuses to which tyranny, the king, can be put. But finally, there came into being a time when a greater amount of central authority needed to come into being. By one of those series of domino events, Israel was faced with a terrible danger. A group of people moved out of the plateau lands of Russia into Greece, and they pushed out the Doric Greeks who had lived there for centuries. The Doric Greeks took to ships, and they conquered Crete and some of the other islands in the Mediterranean. The peoples whom they conquered took to ship, And known as the Sea Peoples, they began an attack upon Egypt, the great granary of the ancient world. They were repelled by the Egyptians, and they began to move up the coast to find some other target of opportunity. They found a number of cities in what is today Israel, Gaza, Ashkelon, Ekron, and they settled there. They conquered these cities and they settled there. We know these people as the Philistines. And the Philistines in the 12th and 11th century began to move out from these few port cities which they conquered. They were people of a high culture. They had iron-tipped weapons and iron-banded wheels to their chariots. They were technologically and militarily superior, both in tactics and in equipment, to the Israelites. And they began to encroach upon Israelite territory. They moved up the coast towards Acre. They moved across the Valley of Jezreel towards the Jordan Valley. Soon they had the tribes of Israel reduced, constricted to a territory which included only the hill country of Judea and some of the land across the Jordan. Israel was desperate. And the Israelites turned to the great charismatic religious leader of the day, Samuel, and they said to Samuel, "Give us a king. Give us a central authority, a man who will organize us for effective defense." Now, we have no record of what actually transpired. We do know that Samuel chose a man named Saul, who was taller than other men by a whole head, a man of power. And he appointed Saul with a more extended commission than any other man in ancient Israel had ever had. And for a while, Saul was able to push back the Philistines, but he was not able to defeat them. And for a variety of reasons, the people turned against Saul. And finally, Samuel appointed another man, David, now not simply as shofet, but as king, and gave him hereditary authority over our people. And David, of course, was able to defeat the Philistines. There is, however, in the Bible a very interesting section in chapter 8 of the first book of Samuel, which tells us something about the reaction of many in Israel to this change in political structure. It's written by those who opposed kingship, who feared tyranny. And they opposed tyranny for two reasons. They opposed it theologically, because according to biblical theory, to demand a king was to say that God lacks the power to defend us. And according to this chapter, God says to Samuel, "Don't you grieve. They have rejected me, they have not rejected you." But the chapter goes on and to suggest in the name of God, that Samuel suggests the name of God to the people, "Watch out. You're asking for a king, but recognize what a king will do. He will take your sons, he will conscript them into his army, and then he will use them to plow his fields and to harvest his crops. And he will take your daughters and take them for his courtiers, for his perfumers, and for his cooks, and for his maids. And when he wants to, he will simply expropriate your land and give it to his favorites. And he will impose upon you taxes so that you will groan under them, taxes for his own pleasures and for his palaces." The Bible is etched in a tradition which fears tyranny. No king in Israel was ever idolized. Whenever the book of Kings writes a moral judgment on any of the kings of Israel, the judgment tends to be bitter. And King so-and-so did that which was evil in the eyes of God. They tried to create the Torah as a constitution to which the king himself was bound. According to Torah law, a king must write a Sefer Torah with his own hand. And at night he must have the Torah read to him. And he must be aware of its teachings and must subscribe and pledge himself to abide the Torah law. And occasionally when a king notoriously violated the Torah, one of the prophets of Israel would suddenly appear before him and point the finger and say, "You have sinned against the law of God. Despite your power, you are a sinner, and God will punish you." Now that's the tradition. But ancient Israel was not able to create the institutions which would in effect limit power, balance power against power. That's a later creation. And the greatest system of checks and balances, of course, is that which is written into our own constitution. Heirs of this long tradition Our fathers in this country wrote a constitution which balanced out powers between an executive, independent but limited, a legislative branch, independent but limited, and a judiciary branch, independent but limited. The executive branch would have powers of administration, could suggest laws, but it could not pass laws. The power of the purse rested with the legislature. If the executive branch exceeded its powers, the Constitution included the right of impeachment. The legislative branch could not administer its own laws. It was to be elected at regular times by the people. It was to consist of a bicameral operation, two houses that they would somehow play one house, which was more privileged, against the other, which was more of a popular base. And its decisions could not only be vetoed by the executive, but they could be reviewed by the judiciary. And the national judiciary was not only empowered to adjudicate in certain areas which involved all of the state, maritime law and the like, but it was allowed to review the constitutionality and the appropriateness of decisions of the executive and of the legislative. There was power, a new experiment in power. But there was an attempt to create power, to divide power into three parts, so that none of these parts would have tyranny, tyrannous power, control over the lives of the people. Now, this was the way in which the Constitutional Convention began to think. And I can't help but add at this point this particularly modern comment. We've recently passed in Ohio a law which requires that all public meetings be open and be reported on if people wish to report on them. I would suggest to you that if the Continental Congress had had open meetings, we would have no constitution today. Continental Congress was called not as a Congress to, the Constitutional Convention was called not as a convention of representatives of the several states to write a new constitution, but as delegates were charged by the states to amend the Articles of Confederation. That is, to create a more effective structure within the older structure, which retained basic sovereignty within the purview of the several states. The very first act of the Constitutional Convention was to close the doors and declare its deliberations secret, and to pledge each and every delegate who managed to get to the Constitutional Convention to secrecy. And to a very, very large degree, the secrecy was maintained from May to November, during the long months in which our Constitution was deliberated. There was a terrible fear, not so much of democracy, because this, whatever they came up with, would have to be ratified by the Congress and by the several states. They were not afraid of letting people judge what they came up with. But they were afraid that if they didn't close the doors, there wouldn't be a chance for each and every one of the men present to speak his mind and to grow and to change his mind. People would be speaking for their constituencies back home. And very quickly there would emerge in the several states organized opposition to whatever they developed. Because most of the states, particularly the smaller states, were very jealous of their state sovereignty, and many of them had specifically directed those who came to the convention not to allow anything to emerge which limited in any way, in any basic way, the sovereignty of Maryland or of Rhode Island or of Delaware or of New Jersey. In point of fact, the representatives in Jersey brought forth during the Constitutional Convention a whole scheme designed to provide some minor alterations in the language of the Articles of Confederation, but based on the proposition that the United States was and should ever remain a confederation of states. The Articles of Confederation had begun, "We, the undersigned delegates of the several states." The American Constitution begins, "We, the people of the United States." And that language suggests the very difference, the basic difference between the two documents. It suggests how far the 55 men who assembled in Philadelphia in 1787 went beyond their mandate, what they were sent there to do. And had they not done so, they would today, I am convinced, not be a constitution, certainly not the constitution that we have. There's an old line in our tradition, "Shtika siyag l'chachma," that silence is sometimes a good fence to wisdom. And though many more of our departmental meetings and public body meetings ought to be open, perhaps, than are open now, somehow I keep remembering that old phrase of Emerson's, "A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds." And to demand that all meetings of every sort always be open, in many ways undermines a very necessary process, part of the democratic process, which is a chance for those whom we elect to represent us to cease representing us long enough to make up their own minds and to listen openly to an issue, so that there is a two-way process. They represent us, but they also bring back to us their good judgment when they've had a chance really to grapple with a problem. But if from the very beginning they must represent the special interests back home, they come to all meetings with a closed mind, and very little change and very little growth can take place. Well, the Constitutional Convention met over those months, and we have no direct record of what was said. No record was kept. A number of diaries exist that were kept privately and were opened up some years later. But clearly, a very high-level discussion of political theory emerged, and men did change their minds. And a rather remarkable degree of unity began to emerge. Not all who left the Constitutional Convention were willing to sign the Constitution. Every once in a while, you'll read of this or that newspaper reporter who, lacking anything to do that day, takes around a copy of the Constitution or the Bill of Rights and asks Americans to sign it, and so many Americans will not. Well, there is a sizable number of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention who refused to sign the final draft. They'd come a long way, and many of them were a little bit frightened. Many of them were clear that they had not written the most perfect of all documents. There are compromises as to slavery, there are compromises as to state rights, many things in here. And when the Constitutional Convention was about to disband, clearly there was another responsibility. The men had to go back to their several states and to secure ratification. And the dean of all of the delegates, Benjamin Franklin, a man then in his early 80s, 20 years older than any other delegate to the convention, the host, because he was the titular government of Pennsylvania, gave one of his very few public addresses during the convention, address which has come down to us. And it's worth reading in part. It's worth reading because it has much of the warmth and the humor that we associate with Mr. Franklin, because it says something about the necessity of being willing to accept ideologically less than perfection, to compromise, to adjust as basic values within a democratic society. "Mr. President," he said, "I confess that I do not entirely approve of this Constitution. But, sir, I am not sure I will ever approve it. For having lived long, I have experienced many instances of being obliged by better information or fuller consideration to change opinions on important subjects, which I once thought right, but later found to be otherwise. It is therefore that the older I grow, the more apt I am to doubt my own judgment and to pay more respect to the judgment of others. Most men, indeed, as well as most sects in religion, think themselves in possession of all truth, and that wherever others differ from them, it is so far error. Mr. Steele, a Protestant in a dedication, tells the Pope that the only difference between our two churches is that their opinions of the is in their opinions of the certainty of the doctrine is this, that the Romish Church is infallible, and the Church of England is never in the wrong. But though many private persons think almost as highly of their own infallibility as that of their sect, few express it as naturally as a certain French lady who in a little dispute with her sister said, "I don't know how it happens, sister, but I meet with nobody but myself that's always in the right." In these sentiments, sir, I agree to this Constitution with all its faults, if such they be, because I think a general government necessary for us, and there is no form of government but what may be a blessing to the people if well administered. And I believe, Father, that this is likely to be well administered for a course of years and can only end in despotism, as other forms have done before it, when the people shall become so corrupted as to need despotic government, being incapable of any others. I doubt, too, whether any other convention we can obtain may be able to make a better constitution. For when you assemble a number of men who have the advantage of their joint wisdom, you inevitably assemble with those men all their prejudices, their passions, their errors of opinion, their local interests, and their selfish views. From such an assembly can a perfect production be expected. Thus I consent, sir, to this constitution because I expect no better, and because I am not sure that it is not the best. The opinions I have had of its errors I sacrifice to the public good. I have never whispered a syllable of them abroad. Within these walls they were born, and here they shall die. If every one of us, in returning to our constituents, were to report the objections he has had to it, and use his influence to gain partisans in support of those objections, we might prevent its being generally received, and thereby lose all the salutary effects and great advantages resulting naturally in our favor among the foreign nations, as well as among ourselves, from our apparent unity. Much of the strength and efficiency of any government in procuring and securing happiness to the people depends on opinion, on the general opinion of the goodness of that government, as well as of the wisdom and integrity of its governors. I hope, therefore, that for our own sakes as a part of the people, and for the sake of our posterity, we shall act heartily and unanimously in recommending this Constitution wherever our influence may extend. The American Constitution was barely ratified. In most states, the vote on ratification in the state legislature hung on a few votes. In New York, in Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and Virginia, the vote was hardly in favor of the Constitution, was hardly a majority. But most men went out of that convention having listened to Mr. Franklin. And they at least put some of their arguments aside and fought for the general proposition. But I wonder if what we think if we relate his final phrase to our own lives. Much of the strength and efficiency of any government in procuring and securing happiness to the people depends on opinion, on the general opinion of the goodness of that government, as well as of the wisdom and integrity of its governors. When we say, as I hear many of us say, "I have lost all faith in the governors in Washington," what are we saying about our own future? What kind of future can we have? If those in power lack our respect, and if we cannot find the capacity to show respect for those who should command it. The American Constitution is not a perfect document. It includes many compromises. It's based on a rather calculated and unflattering assumption about human nature. But it's generally been a good constitution. It's worked. It's given our people, us, a measure of freedom unrivaled in our world. But as everyone who was part of that Constitutional Convention knew, the success of the Constitution rests less on the words than on the men and women who would be governed by it and who would govern through it. And I would submit to you that today as then, the strength of our nation depends ultimately on the quality of its citizens and of those whom the citizens choose to be leaders. And here I think we have, all of us, a long, long way to go. Amen.
Speak about America, than many of you would. What could I say about America? I live here, I'm hopefully growing up here, and I'll probably eventually find a job here. But that doesn't mean I ever really think about America. It hardly ever crosses my mind, perhaps only in political conjunction with something else. like its role in the Mideast crisis, its attitudes towards detente. And I'm studying history in school, but I haven't yet taken a United States history course. I don't feel like I'm a part of the war for independence, the writing of the Constitution, and I certainly don't feel a part of the Civil War and our past of slavery. Somehow, my roots are back in the old world, back in Europe. I have a roommate who studies only American domestic politics. He is already an aspiring young politician, and he can't understand what I see in the European Cultural Studies program of which I'm a part. It's hard to explain to him that European history is more exciting, stimulating to me than American. And it's even harder to admit the chauvinistic reasons why I choose to study European life at the turn of the century. After all, it seems that we Jews have been at the forefront of almost every intellectual and cultural movement in Europe during the last century. But that's why I'm thankful to Rabbi Silver for making me stop and think about my attitudes towards America. Many Europeans dismiss America for selling its cultural soul to become the giant of modern technology. And I too seem in part to have fallen to that same prejudice. So it's a good time to suspend my chauvinism and think about my country. Maybe America is unique in just the respect of us not having a dominant culture. One could easily assign a stereotype to the British, French, German, and Russian type, their so-called national personality and culture. But what does one say about America after passing through the cliches of the American frontier character? It may be true that the Anglo-Saxon heritage is the most obvious, but I don't feel that it now monopolizes other cultures to any great extent. At school, I still find that if one asks people what nationality they are, they will invariably respond, "I'm Scotch, I'm Korean, I'm Black, or I'm Jewish," or any mixture of the above, but not, "I'm American." Ours is an ethnic society. The old melting pot ideal of complete assimilation has not materialized. What has resulted instead is more of a loose amalgamation. Each element in society seems to be retaining its uniqueness while mixing with the others to form a new whole. People are reaffirming themselves by withdrawing from an assimilated ideal to gain an identity as a Jewish American, a Franco-American, or an Afro-American. This movement may be beneficial to our country. It's better that an individual does not have to subordinate him or herself to the will of a great homogeneous culture, be it German, Ugandan, or Russian. And unlike the Uganda or Russia of today, America does not forcibly impose a standard uniform ideology or culture. The Soviet Union is a land of many minorities, but its government's policy reveals a great Russian nationality bias. In jobs, economic opportunities, and even political liberties, there is discrimination against Latvians, Cossacks, Uzbeks, and the rest. The government decides which ethnic languages and local customs to support. It tries to suppress any dissident intellectual movements from its provinces. The Soviet Union is only continuing the policies of its Tsarist predecessor in their intensive Russification program leveled primarily against Poles, Finns, and Jews. The logical extension of their solution is the Ugandan experience, expulsion of all non-national elements. But in the United States, despite pressures to conform to our white Protestant society, there is no overt effort to regulate the lives and attitudes of our people. Diversity is almost an American tradition. That is not to say there isn't prejudice, but Blacks, Italians, Jews, and whatever can be found at almost every level of American life. There are multitudes of languages, religions, and customs practiced without fear in public. A particular cultural experience, like Black soul music, can be adopted by the whole country for its own. I think America can only be described as a pluralistic society embracing a myriad of cultures. I don't know much of American history, but it seems to me that the development of a looser-knit heterogeneous society was not an accident. America did not generally instill the social stratification that was so prevalent in Europe. Many of the first immigrants came to America to escape the domination of a particularly distasteful religious culture. Although originally there was little mingling between groups, the need for greater defensive and economic cooperation brought the differing peoples gradually together despite themselves. Even with the successive waves of immigration, social mobility was never denied to any group except possibly to the Blacks. Incoming groups could quickly acclimate themselves to their new American life, integrate themselves into the business and intellectual spheres of America while still retaining their own roots. It is evident that here in Cleveland, no matter what the mix in the industrial or business life of the community, people still tend to live together with people of a similar cultural heritage. We have our Black, our Hungarian, Anglo-Saxon, and Jewish ghettos. But if various people can then attend school and work together, the retention of culture can only enrich our lives. I think heterogeneity has facilitated America's growth and development. It has given the United States an advantage over the more narrow, homogeneous Europe. My experiences in college with social integration among people with different cultures has been distressing. Interracial activities, as well as interaction between those of varying cultural backgrounds, occurred less frequently and less easily than in high school. At college, polarities have become increasingly more obvious. Segregation has spread from a matter of reaffirming cultural identity to a whole way of life. The social life at school, to a large degree, still revolves around the eating clubs. Although the clubs have lost some of their more heinous characteristics in the last 10 years, they still serve as a crude reminder of exclusiveness. 7 of our 11 clubs are selective. After those club members interview a person, they discuss whether he or she would fit into the club mold and then vote for or against acceptance. 3 of the clubs are all-male institutions. A recent vote at the club to which a roommate of mine belongs rejected a motion to admit women by count of 120-5. An insubstantial number of Jews and almost no Blacks belong to these same clubs. Although I have friends at the clubs and occasionally enjoy partying there, philosophically they repel me. Exclusiveness carried to an extreme can only breed a narrowness in outlook and an inflated sense of personal worth. In my opinion, the clubs foster a subtle racism and more blatant sexism. The point, I think, is that exclusiveness, whether by nation or by group, is dangerous. If one culture gains hegemony over the rest, ingrown prejudices and stultification of ideas ensue. I think our country, more than most, has respected the differences of its people, although it seems that the leaders in the Pentagon and the large multinational corporations are disquietingly homogeneous in background. Overall, our country has shown a willingness to accept new people and to at least consider new ideas. We may not have as much of an interesting culture or history as Europe, but perhaps that is a good thing. People and ideas evolving from different cultures can provide tensions which can lead to innovations and create an impetus to progress. Perhaps that we don't all think that much about America is in itself a good sign. There have been few times in our Jewish history when we have been able to afford the luxury of not having the status of our relationship to the state continually thrust upon us. The question of whether we are Jewish Americans or American Jews is superfluous, for the United States has enabled our culture to freely express itself. America, because of its past, stands for the maintenance of a pluralistic society. I hope that in pursuing a European history, I can at the same time better understand the antecedents of some of the different cultures in this country which have participated in our country's progress. America means to me the striving for diversity, and from that, the chance and hope for future growth.
When Rabbi Silver wrote to me, asking me to participate in today's service, I was naturally very excited. But then I realized that in preparing this speech, I was going to have to approach what is often a superficial subject in anything but a superficial way. At that point, I must confess, my excitement disappeared. Finally, however, my work proved to be a real eye-opener, for it forced me to evaluate not only American history, but my own relationship to it. Beyond the Coca-Cola commercials imploring us to look up America was a more meaningful bicentennial, a more meaningful perception of America, and somehow I had to find it. As a student of antebellum history, the celebration of 200 years of American independence has been a refreshing opportunity to correlate my academic pursuits with the national preoccupation. From my own research has emerged a sense not only of the importance of history for understanding the present, but also of the abiding permanence of that history. In 1835, the Frenchman Alexis de Tocqueville visited the United States and wrote of the then fledgling nation, "In America, even more than in Europe, there is only one society, composed everywhere of the same elements. The plane of a uniform civilization has passed over it." De Tocqueville's observation keenly captured the leveling factor in the American experience of 1835, and to a great degree holds true for the American experience 140 years later. The peculiar combination of a conscious striving for democratic processes and a perception of leading the world into a new era of history rendered 19th century America radically different from its European parents and had profound effects on even its most recent arrivals. The United States was more than an agglomeration of subcultures, for it imposed upon those subcultures a transcendent and peculiarly American experience. It passed over them the plane of a new civilization. Today, that American experience has been refined and packaged into our American heritage. Yet despite its simplification and despite its present commercialization, it still underlies our society. The United States has retained its brashness, its expansiveness, and its own perception of itself as derived but essentially separate from the older European societies. The scope of American action has broadened, and the action itself has changed. But nonetheless, it still is informed, American history is still informed by this unique experience. The basic themes of our history remain. I have been brought up within this American experience and have willingly retained it. I have always considered myself thoroughly American. Yet in examining American history, I have realized that it is not fully my history. True, as a member of the latest generation of what was once an immigrant family, my own ties are to the United States, not to Europe. But I cannot escape the fact that the antebellum history I love is not the history of my family, nor of most families in this temple today. As Jews, we entered that history after it had been established and accepted as the unique force that it is. We took from the American experience and thereby remolded our own Jewish European heritage. And in time, we contributed significantly to the ongoing development of that same experience. Yes, we have been leveled in the Tocquevillian sense of the word. One might even say we have been assimilated. Nonetheless, when it comes to American Jews, de Tocqueville's observations are in the end inadequate. Perhaps because we've been distinguished by our religion and not just our ancestors' immigration, we American Jews have remained one of the most cohesive subgroups in the scheme of American history. Despite our assimilation, we have remained in many ways autonomous. We have our own social as well as religious groups. We are a political group whose votes are sought. It is in this sense of being a Jew within American society, and not just an American who happens to be a Jew, that the bicentennial begins to have a significant meaning for me. Like other Americans, this celebration is a time for me to reflect on 200 years of truly unique history. As a Jew, it is a time to reaffirm my commitment to Judaism within the scope of that history. During the 1973 Mideast War, and again during the United Nations debate on Zionism, I have seen the Jewish students on my campus seriously concern themselves with their tenuous roles as Jews within America. For me, these events, combined with the national and my personal interest in American history, have convinced me of the duality of my own role. I am an American, but I am also a Jew. These roles cannot, and indeed must not, be one and the same.
For hundreds of people, known or unknown to me, many of whom pay a high price for the defense of these same principles of human rights, the price being loss of freedom, unemployment, poverty, persecution, exile from one's country, your decision was a great personal joy and a gift. I'm aware of all of this, but I'm also aware of another fact. In the present situation, it is an act of intellectual courage and great equity to grant the award to a man whose ideas do not coincide with official concepts of the leadership of a big and powerful state. This, in fact, is how I value the decision of the Nobel Committee. These words would seem strange to most of us if uttered by an American, but they were not. These are the words of a Russian, Andrei Sakharov, who was recently unable to accept the 1975 Nobel Peace Prize because Soviet officials refused to grant Sakharov, an advocate of human rights and greater democracy in the Soviet Union, a visa to accept the award in Norway. The closing of the acceptance speech, presented on his behalf by his wife, stated, "The honor which was thus granted to me is shared by all prisoners of conscience in the Soviet Union and in other Eastern European countries," a conclusion which also conjures an image which is alien to most Americans. For although there are, by some accounts, over 10,000 political prisoners in the Soviet Union, the idea has no place in America. Fortunately, we in the United States have political freedoms which others lack, especially the freedom of speech, which allows us to question and discuss, and if necessary, to dissent and challenge. Politically, America is the freest nation in the world today. Although Americans today are not as free as our forefathers due to the increased complexity of modern life and the consequent increase in government regulation, we are the freest people relative to our contemporaries. Yet our freedom is not absolutely secure, as there are challenges to it from each of us and from the system about us. But let us focus our attention on what many consider our most fundamental freedom, that of speech. Free speech is essential to a democracy. It allows us to speak as we wish, within reason, and encourages us to decide issues for ourselves. Freedom of speech, to speak from a pulpit, to communicate with friends, to express ourselves, to question and challenge what is wrong, evil, or unjust. In his essay on liberty, John Stuart Mill cited another important value of free speech. It's necessary to find the truth. If there's no liberty, then the accepted truths cannot be discussed, tested, or modified. On one hand, he writes, if the opinion is right, mankind is deprived of the opportunity of exchanging error for truth. Whereas on the other hand, if it is wrong, they lose what is almost as great a benefit, the clearer perception and livelier impression of truth produced by its collision with error. However, since man is not infallible, we can never be absolutely sure we're stifling a false opinion. And since truth is a balance between two sides, as exhibited by the adversary nature of our legal system, freedom of discussion is necessary for both sides of the issue to be heard and for the real truth to be found. It is our loss of sight of the importance of free speech which imperils it the most. The internal threat to freedom which emanates from each of us is that we become lax and complacent, and we take what we have for granted. We lower our guard. We cease the constant vigil which is necessary for the preservation of our liberties. Liberty is a frail plant. It needs nurturing, protection, and attention. It's an affection which some peoples, but not all, have cultivated, and which must be continuously tended lest we lose it and its benefits. Alexis de Tocqueville, a Frenchman who visited our country in the 1830s and 40s and wrote an epic tome about his impressions, realized the perils and extra burdens of freedom. In speaking to the French people on how they were losing their taste for freedom, he expressed a lesson which is extremely relevant to us in America today. He wrote, "Some nations have freedom in their blood and are ready to face the greatest perils and hardships in its defense. It is not for what it offers on the material plane that they love it. They regard freedom itself as something so precious, so needful to their happiness, that no other boon could compensate for its loss, and its enjoyment consoles them even in their darkest hours. Other nations, since they have grown prosperous, lose interest in freedom and let it be snatched from them without lifting a hand to defend it, lest they should endanger the comforts that, in fact, they owe to it alone. It is easy to see that what is lacking in such nations is a genuine love of freedom, that lofty aspiration which, I confess, defies analysis. For it is something one must feel, and logic has no part in it." America used to be the former, clinging to its precious freedom with all its might, each citizen resisting any challenge to it. But that's no longer clear. Yes, we send our sons to war. We fight the enemy. But what if the enemy is ourselves? We must now be wary of becoming the second of Tocqueville's nations, of losing our personal feeling and fervor for freedom, of becoming lax and complacent about our liberties. Each of us must continue to tend our own and our communal garden, lest the frail plants for which we care, and which in turn benefit us, should wither away. In examining the current condition of our political freedoms, we can see the external threats which are chipping away at them. Although we have the most freedom of speech, external factors have been eroding it. First, it's important to note that economic factors often inhibit the free speech of many. The lack of economic resources inhibits the political efficacy of many and also precludes their pursuit of their freedoms. For instance, many often lack the economic resources or opportunities needed to gain a forum or a medium for speech. Few Americans have the forum access of William Randolph Hearst, just as not everyone is given the opportunity to speak from a pulpit to a captive audience. Government activity is also eroding our freedom of speech. Consider, for example, the recently disclosed FBI and CIA surveillance of Americans for political purposes, an activity which is now known to have begun at the behest of Franklin Roosevelt and continued through the presidency of Richard Nixon. True, the public's esteem for both agencies has fallen dramatically, as shown by a recent Gallup poll, but the effects on our freedom are much, much more substantial. Surveillance inhibits freedom. While permitting free exercise, the result is not the equivalent of freedom. Rather, it's a manipulated pseudo-freedom. Even if the surveillance goes unnoticed by the victim, it intimidates and diminishes the power and value of free speech. After all, if Big Brother is watching, he knows all that will occur and can more efficiently stifle it. Moreover, the door is thereby open for police state tactics, which we've come to expect from repressive governments, such as that of the Soviet Union, rather than that of the United States. Nevertheless, despite all this, the FBI is seeking more power to, quote, obstruct or prevent threats to the essential functioning of government. Another major example of the menace of government is a bill now before the Senate, S-1. Ostensibly, its goal is to revise and reform the U.S. Criminal Code. While some sections are admirable, the real purpose of important parts of the bill, warns the American Civil Liberties Union, is, quote, to perpetuate secrecy and stifle protest. For instance, several sections establish what amounts to an Official Secrets Act. They make it a crime to disclose, receive, or possess classified information. The problems are several: a broad definition of national defense information, which invites abuse; special wartime provisions which do not require a congressional declaration of war and could thus be used to repress dissenters; and the fact that too many documents are already unnecessarily classified. Other sections of the bill inhibit free speech as well. It provides for domestic security wiretaps without court permission, contrary to Supreme Court rulings. It virtually reenacts the notorious Smith Act. In addition, it makes it criminal to communicate a statement which, quote, is in fact false about losses, plans, operations, or conduct of the military forces of the U.S. or of an associate nation or enemy. This provision binds the press and the people, as it makes reporting errors punishable, even though done in good faith, and more importantly, could be used to stifle the real truth as opposed to the military's truth. The acts of other nations and our own foreign policy are a final threat to our freedom. However, after the debacle of Vietnam, it should be clear that we should not and cannot defend freedom everywhere at any cost. The fate of every nation is not a threat to our liberty. Instead of seeking to contain each act of communist expansion, we must examine these quote-unquote aggressions and determine whether or not they are actually vital to our security. We must abandon the assumption that the maintenance of the entire free world is vital to our security and must selectively use our limited resources. The fact that we've been able to live with the communist Southeast Asia attests to the fallaciousness of this assumption and should lead us to more selective exertion of our efforts. So you ask, what are we to do with all these challenges menacing our freedoms? That's precisely the point, to do something. Only 3% of Americans have ever written a letter to the editor. 1.5% write most of them. Only about 5% of all American adults have ever written their congressman. As I see it, you have three alternatives after leaving the service. The first is to forget what we've said. The second one is to politely discuss it, comment upon it, then forget it or shelve it in the back of your minds. Or third, to remember it and go out and try and do something about it. I hope you'll choose a third. Don't just sit back and let our liberties wither away. Had the founding fathers been as apathetic as most Americans are today, the United States would never have been conceived. Effort, activity, and perseverance were necessary to establish our liberties 200 years ago, and they're still necessary to preserve them for today and for tomorrow.